online and on the web at WJFFradio.org. 845-482-4141.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, coronavirus cases continue to rise across the country and across our listening area. We turn to our very own in-house doctor, Jim Lomax, for guidance on the worrisome trends, the vaccine, and public safety. Managing grief during the holidays. The holiday season, just like everything else this year, won't look the same as usual. We'll get some strategies for making the most of a less than ideal situation. And tomorrow is the Transgender Day of Remembrance. We'll chat with Julie Gray Owens of Gender Equality New York about how she sees this day as not only a day to remember, but a day to fight for transgender rights. First, the news from NPR.
From NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The coronavirus pandemic in the U.S. is breaking records. The latest numbers from Johns Hopkins University shows more than 184,000 cases reported on Friday, the highest ever. And as Will Stone reports, more states are turning to new restrictions in response to the spike.
In many places, the number of cases is growing exponentially. New infections are up about 80% nationwide over the past 2 weeks. It's even worse in the Northeast and Midwest, where cases have doubled. COVID hospitalizations are at an all-time high. Dr. William Schaffner is with the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases.
The virus really looks as though it's not controlled anywhere in this country now.
That's led New Mexico to issue a stay-at-home order and Oregon a partial lockdown. In the Northeast and parts of California, state leaders are halting indoor dining and closing some businesses. For NPR News, I'm Will Stone.
North Dakota is now among the states tightening restrictions aimed at containing the coronavirus. The state's Republican governor had resisted a statewide mask mandate, but Governor Doug Burgum has reversed himself, signing an executive order requiring they be worn.
To be clear, these are statewide requirements, not simply recommendations.
Governor Burgum speaking in a video posted to his Twitter page last night. His executive order also includes restrictions on businesses and the suspension of high school winter sports and extracurricular activities until December 14th. The order goes into effect today. With hospitals in his state nearing capacity, Idaho's Republican governor is reimposing some of the state's original coronavirus restrictions. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports the governor is refusing to implement a statewide mask law.
Idaho Governor Brad Little has mostly resisted rolling the state back into tougher restrictions that were in effect until the end of May. Despite a record number of cases and hospitalizations, especially in urban counties, bars, nightclubs here will mostly be able to remain open. Public gatherings will be limited to 10 people, but those rules won't apply to churches or political rallies. The conservative governor has faced criticism from healthcare workers for not enforcing tougher measures, while also getting criticism from the right wing of his own party for implementing any restrictions. The announcement came on the same day that two neighboring states, Washington and Oregon, announced new travel advisories for out-of-state visitors. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
President Trump says he refuses to impose another lockdown, but during yesterday's Rose Garden press conference on vaccine progress, he suggested that one could be implemented if another administration takes over. That's the closest he's come to acknowledging Joe Biden's victory. Meanwhile, far-right groups and other supporters of President Trump are planning to rally in the nation's capital today in a show of support for the president's unfounded claim of widespread voter fraud, protests, and counter-protests planned in other major cities as well. This is NPR News.
To navigate breaking news, but behind the big headlines are so many other voices and stories to be told. I'm Leila Faldin, and I'm a national correspondent for NPR. After the police killing of George Floyd, people in Minneapolis took to the streets in protest, and I went to bring those voices to our airwaves. I found anger at a system so many people said not only failed them, but endangered them. I met Keisha Mitchell among the demonstrators. She has diabetes, and if she got sick with COVID-19, it could be fatal.
I made the choice to give up my life knowing that this is so important. People are being harassed, we're dying, and we're afraid to be in our own communities.
When a major story breaks, when there are more voices to hear, it's my job to go out and listen and bring them to you. and it's your donations that make my work possible. Here's how you can help.
Donations from people like you make this station possible. Listeners provide the funding that keeps the news, information, and arts alive. I'm Donna Fellenberg, host of WJFF's Catskill Character. Whether it's reliable information you can use or joyful music that inspires the community, Radio Catskill provides programming you rely on. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Your contribution enables us to keep you connected. Please donate now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today's headline in the New York Times says it's traumatizing. U.S. coronavirus cases are climbing once again. In New York City, in-person instruction at public schools will be halted if the seven-day positivity rate goes over 3%. The city is now at 2.8%. That could happen as soon as Monday, then. Positivity rates in the states immediately surrounding us, our neighbors, New Jersey, the positivity rate at 6%. In Pennsylvania, it's at 19%. New restrictions went into effect last night in New York State as gyms, bars, and restaurants now have to close at 10 p.m. In Sullivan County, the Public Health Department issued an advisory for possible COVID-19 exposures at a restaurant in Liberty. An employee at Cassie's Family Diner on Sullivan Avenue in Liberty tested positive for COVID-19 yesterday and may have unknowingly exposed customers on the following dates and times, November 6th through 8th, November 12th, and Friday, November 13th from 6 a.m. to 1 p.m. Contact investigations are ongoing. Public Health Director Nancy McGraw says if someone thinks they've been exposed and develop symptoms, they should self-quarantine for 14 days and call their health care provider and the Sullivan County Public Health Services on 845-292-5910. The numbers are traumatizing. We turn to our own in-house doctor, Jim Lomax, who says that the holiday season with people traveling more on Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa holidays, and with winter as more people are inside, those are elements that could conspire to increase COVID-19.
I would say that we're heading up for a medical crisis, that by January of 2021, if the models still hold and that people are not following any particular, if they're doing as they do now with inconsistent use of masks and, you know, the normal things that we know what to do to prevent us, we're looking at some really terrible statistics with, you know, over 2,000 deaths per day. And again, by March, it's a possibility that, again, if with even with the vaccine, there could be close to 400,000 deaths that is possible. Again, it depends a lot on our behavior going forward.
And do you think that the impact of that is sinking into folks in terms of public health protocols? It sounds like it's not.
Well, I hope so, because when you start, like, for instance, as you quoted in the statistics, there were on Thursday, there was 134,000 plus new cases reported. And again, the death rate went over 240,000. So this is just a model that they're following. But again, who knows what will be at the end of January, but the next 3 months are going to be very, very difficult for all of us, because the states are going to be doing something. Certainly living in New York State, there's going to be some foreclosures, some restrictions, not a close down of the economy, but basically a restriction of hours and other things, and perhaps doing away with indoor dining and things of that nature. So there's going to be a lot of changes coming up depending on how things go. Right now, we're about 2.2% positivity rate. And I think if it goes over 3, we're going to go back to homeschooling again with the, you know, in closing public schools in New York State, certainly in New York City, and I'm sure about the rest of the state of New York. That again, depends on the governor and his advisors as far as what to do.
Well, and this week the governor also announced new restrictions on indoor gatherings, limited private indoor gatherings, limited to 10 people. Also, bars, restaurants can't open past 10 o'clock, so that is foreshadowing what you're saying.
I mean, I assume it applies to our community. Again, I marvel at the restaurants and other facilities that stayed open during this particular time. But again, it's going to, with these kind of restrictions, shortening hours, and also crowd sizes, and the fact that now winter is coming, we're going to be spending most of our time inside. Inside dining is going to go. So I'm not sure exactly what the effect of on restaurants and other businesses in our areas, but it's going to be profound, certainly.
Let's talk a little bit more about the vaccine. You mentioned the vaccine earlier. What, there was a lot of fanfare about the Pfizer vaccine,
yeah.
And what do you think of that?
I think it's great, but I think, again, the Pfizer, this vaccine was actually almost in existence when this pandemic began back in January. There was a basic vaccine already produced, and that's why they've been able to get it up and to phase 3 and do their statistics and things like that. That's how they were able to do it so quickly. Right behind them, there's other companies that are going to be applying for emergency use, you know, such as Moderna and the University of Oxford and AstraZeneca. All these vaccines are somewhat the same, but very different in their own way. But again, it would depends on their effectiveness rate. So rather than get into the weeds about how these things work, these vaccines will be great, but there are some things that people need to know about it. First of all, I think there's a very good possibility they'll be able to start some immunizations by the end of December, 1st of January again, after emergency approval by the FDA, that there's going to be about 30 million doses reserved for use here in the United States. The other 20 are going to be starting to be distributed in Europe and other places. However, that 30 million sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot because this is a two-shot immunization. 3 weeks apart, and then they say, in at least what I've been reading and what's been printed in the press, is the fact that the immunity begins after 1 week. So it takes a whole month to develop this. But again, it's two shots. The other thing about this vaccine and probably other vaccines that are going to be coming out, it requires very, very special handling. These vaccines are very, very delicate, and so they have to be frozen at extremely cold temperatures, about equivalent to about 75 degrees centigrade and maybe 104 Fahrenheit, which is dry ice temperature. And how are you going to distribute this around the country? And who will be set up and available for actually giving the injections themselves? It's not going to be the family doctor, at least initially. It's going to be hospitals, special centers, things like that. And again, all that is just starting to be organized right now. So that's going to be logistically a significant thing. And it's going to take a while to ramp up even beyond that. If we get several of these companies, it'll certainly allow us to give more use sooner, but it's going to probably be early summer before it's going to be available in our area for people with average risk factors.
You're not going to be able to walk into your local drugstore and just get a shot.
You can't get it at CVS.
Right.
No. Maybe in time, there might be some vaccines From what I know, one of them, they were talking about basically not requiring refrigeration, and that would be a big help. But again, the early ones are going to require this very extreme cold storage. So it's going to be, and again, some will be one shot and some will be two shots. So again, it's going to depend on what's available in our particular area. So again, that's going to be something that people have to realize. It's not going to be instant gratification. And then the third point about this is the fact that even with vaccines availability and people slowly getting them, hopefully everyone would want them, but again, that's not always the case. Some people are very afraid of vaccines and will not take them at all. You're going to have to get at least 50, 60% of the population in any community immunized in order for the the actual infection rate from the coronavirus to begin to decrease significantly. So it's a matter of people's willingness to take this new vaccine. And this is a new type of vaccine. We've never been used on humans before. So again, it's the phase 3 by Pfizer showed basically it was effective and well tolerated. But again, it takes a lot to convince the general public of this. And the other thing is that even though if everyone gets on the bandwagon, wears their masks and hand disinfecting and staying out of crowds, and it's still going to probably be, we're going to be wearing masks throughout the 2021 until such time as there's enough immunity in the community from the vaccination programs.
That might be sobering for some folks to hear who are thinking might be past it.
I'm sure what other people have heard on the general news is that CDC and all the other experts are really recommending the fact that even for our traditional holidays coming up, Thanksgiving and Christmas, Passover and all the other other types of holidays we have this time of year, it's basically they're saying don't do it. You know, if you're going to have Thanksgiving dinner, fine, but you need to have it with your family, but not your extended family, you know, outside your household. So, again, that's going to be a significant sacrifice for many families, because this is sometimes the time of the year that you get to see the grandparents and the aunts and uncles and all the other people that you normally wouldn't see during the year. So it's going to be a tremendous sacrifice for people, and it's certainly going to be resented by many.
Back to the vaccine for a moment. In the normal course of introducing a new drug or treatment, these things usually take years. There have been, you know, obviously this has been sped up. But when it comes to introducing this in these trials and these phases, are they still going to be studying the impact of this on
humans?
They'll
be studying these vaccines for years. They'll be following this very carefully. Normally you wouldn't get this kind of fast approval. But again, this is emergency approval by the FDA. But it's going to be followed for years. And there'll be probably tweaking of the vaccines themselves. I think probably getting away from finding a way of not requiring special handling will be a very important part of getting these vaccines to the rest of the world, and particularly third world countries that don't have electricity and all the other stuff, you know, for this. So it's going to be studied for a long time.
Earlier you mentioned that they're getting to work on how this is getting distributed. And who will it be distributed to first, those most at risk?
Most at risk, but also your first responders, all your hospital personnel. That includes doctors, nurses, janitors, anyone dealing or having any kind of contact with the potential COVID patients. All these people will get in vaccinated first. And that's what the initial 30 million by Pfizer Biotech will be reserved for in the United States. They say by the first of next year they'll have about 1 billion doses available for distribution. And again, that'll be more than just for the United States, but, you know, worldwide too. So it's going to take a while to ramp up just the availability of these vaccines enough to make a true difference in the communities.
since that's going to take some time, we need to be vigilant about public health precautions, right?
We cannot change our routine. We have to really be so mindful of wearing masks and, again, all the other things that we know. We repeat this mantra till we're blue in the face, but, again, it's the only way that's going to for us to get rid of this. And it's probably, some experts I've been listening to say that it's going to probably be close to 2022 before things really begin to settle into some kind of normal pace. So it's going to be a long time. This coming year is going to be a very difficult year for many of us.
A lot of sacrifice for everyone.
I'm going to be repeating the mantra that we have to, all of us, there's no exception, has to be responsible for protecting themselves and for the people around them, and that's, again, the use of the masks. And it's a shame that this whole mask thing has become a political football. It's not that big of a deal to put a mask on. And, again, I think people, if they want to go resume a normal life, you know, has basically got to encourage not only themselves, their family, but also strangers to wear masks when they're out in public.
While I have you talking to the community, I'd like to ask you a little bit about community radio and the message that we provide. It's our fall pledge drive, as you know, and we've been filling in information and news like this locally. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement? You're a longtime volunteer and former board president, and why it's important for folks to support community radio.
Well, community radio is, again, one of the major ways that people get information in their daily life. And again, WGFF has been doing this for 30 years plus. I think, again, the kinds of programming we've been having now recently since the start of this COVID pandemic has been excellent, really solid information, again, not without hype, but basically factual. And that's really what we have to listen to is facts. And again, the public radio is basically one of the major ways that information gets out. People listen to us, in the radio, at home, and hopefully we'll benefit from it. But again, we've been doing it for a long time, and it's been I've been quite pleased. I haven't been on the board since last year, but I've been very pleased with the programming that's you and your staff have put together for all of us.
And if you support that, please donate at wjffradio.org and show your support for community radio and for the facts. We've been getting facts today from Dr. Jim Lomax, and you can look for his column in the River Reporter coming up in December. Is that right?
Correct. Correct.
Jim, thank you so much for filling us in, and stay safe and be well.
Okay. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Take care.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As you heard, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic, chances are this holiday season will mean something different for many who look forward to a full table at Thanksgiving or a big party on New Year's Eve. These changes are unwelcome and maybe even a little depressing. In response, people may experience emotions ranging from guilt to loneliness to a feeling of disconnected sadness or grief. Anna Walsh is a social worker at Way Memorial Health who is facilitating a support group beginning November 23rd designed to help people cope with surviving the holidays. She explains it's not like regular counseling. We should note that Way Memorial is an underwriter of WJFF.
Counseling is much more a one-to-one individual. Usually it's you know, generally someone who's a therapist or a licensed therapist or psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever, and an individual, person, one-to-one. This is a group support setting. So, we've had two or three people. We've had 13 people at a time. It's kind of a difficult way to, sort of predict how many or how few, but no one is ever discouraged. It's kind of a drop-in, drop-out. So, we run 6-week session this time. for the holidays. And if people come once, that's great. If they come all six, that's great. Sometimes, you know, people think that they're ready and they come a couple of times and find that they're just not for whatever reason. So we never say, you know, don't come. We never say, you know, no one calls and says, well, why weren't you there, or, you know, any of that sort of thing. We just, you know, kind of allow people to come and go as they need to.
Do you see an increase in the need for the group support during the holiday season?
In particular, I mean, especially now with, you know, so many other changes in the world as we used to know it, there is a need, because people, you know, for the holidays, most people are joyful. They're, you know, getting ready. They have traditions. They have celebrations. You know, everybody's sort of upbeat, lighthearted. And for someone who's lost someone, particularly long-time relationships, you know, folks that have been married for 60 and 70 years, and, you know, parents and children and spouses and significant others, it's a, you know, a gamut of people. But during the holidays, you know, everybody around us generally is you know, moving forward and preparing and anticipating. And for someone who's lost someone, it really can become a time of real dread.
As you said, life as we used to know it, I mean, this year has been so terrible when it comes to the amount of death in the country, in the area. Does that impact people as well in terms of how they're trying to express grief in coming to terms with it?
It definitely does. You know, the support systems that we've all become accustomed to, other family members, our friends, our neighbors, you know, even our religious support systems are very different these days. And people who could normally, you know, come and be with you and come and support you if you've lost someone are not there. They're not capable of being there. They're not able to be there. Not that they wouldn't want to, but, you know, there are restrictions all over the place for various reasons and for everyone's safety. And so, you know, our traditional support systems in terms of what we've always, you know, used in the past, you know, grief is sort of cumulative. Every time you grieve, you sort of log that experience somewhere in your conscious, unconscious, and each time you have a new grief, you sort of go back to that to say, well, how did it feel, and who was there for me, and how did I get through, and what did I do, and, you know, all those kind of things. And now all of those other things have changed, so it naturally sort of rolls over into, you know, how you deal with grief, you know, now, and particularly with the holidays. You know, getting ready for things. You know, if you've always done it as a family, that may not be possible any longer. If you've always had your spouse, you know, to help prepare even around the home and things like that. I mean, all of those things have changed. So it's definitely a kind of a domino effect all the way around.
It could compound the grief then as well.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Grief is something that I think that people might think of as negative. Obviously, it's painful, it's emotional, but it's something that you need to deal with, to work through. Is that how you approach it?
It is. And I always, you know, say, and you know, even in our, you know, literature that we put out about the support groups, you know, everybody grieves differently. We all have some similarities, but every individual handles things very, very differently. We all handle change very differently. So, you know, there is no timeline. There is no, you know, we hear people say, well, you know, it's been this amount of time or that amount of time, this person should be over it or whatever. But grief is one of those things that if you don't deal with it, however you deal with it, it will just continue to come back repeatedly, sometimes when you least expect it and are least capable of trying to cope with it, until you sort of process through it. And the process, you know, for some people, I mean, we've had individuals in the past that, you know, the loss was, you know, 40 years ago and more, but, you know, how they're processing at 40 years past is different than they processed it, you know, a day after the, you know, the situation took place. So, you know, we all sort of move through these things in our own ways, in our own paces, but there is no good, bad, wrong, right? Everybody, you know, as an individual does that very, very differently. And the support group is there to kind of encourage people to share, well, you know, what had worked for you, I may be able to use something that you're saying to help me that I've never used before, never thought of before. And so that sharing, you know, on that same sort of level, because the commonality is the grief, the loss, can sometimes be, you know, so helpful to somebody else because it's just that thing that they needed to hear at that moment.
this support group is certainly a step for folks to share their grief and to come to terms with it. Mm-hmm. What are some other things you advise people to do to take that first step to dealing with grief?
Well, I think, you know, what I've also encountered, I did some additional training and certification recently because I believe we grieve loss of loved ones, but we also grieve different things. We grieve the loss of a home or the loss of a job or, things that now in the world, again, you know, vacations that were planned and trips that were planned, we're, you know, sort of grieving on a different level. But all of those things, you know, again, kind of become part of who we are, and we put them somewhere to get by and get through. But, having somebody, you know, even if it's only one person that you can sort of call and just say, you know, when they say, well, how are things going? Most people just want to hear, oh, you know, I'm doing okay. But, you know, for a lot of folks, when they say, well, I'm really not, you know, I'm really not doing well, and I need to have at least one person to be able to sort of, you know, share that with, that the other person isn't going to say, well, I don't have time to listen, or, you know, you're handling this the wrong way, or if it was me, I would do blah, whatever. That one person that they can connect with, you know, from time to time is some, you know, sometimes the most important. And whether it's another family member, I mean, it often comes that, you know, a parent doesn't want to burden a child who's now checking in on the parent, because they feel as though that, you know, that parent has, you know, the wherewithal to get by on their own, and they don't want to burden a child or an adult child or, you know, any of those kind of things. So, you know, figuring out who it is that can best be that support for that, you know, person who's grieving. And sometimes it's the sharing. You know, the parent is grieving on one level and the child is grieving on the other, and one is grieving a parent's loss, the other is grieving a spouse's loss. But they're both grieving, and they're both grieving a loss. So sometimes connecting on that other level, you know, allows them to be more open. The other thing that's happened in a lot of cases is the, you know, the spouse or the parent has also been the primary caregiver. So they're grieving on two levels. They've lost their job, if you want to term it that way. The responsibility that they've had for taking care of this other person, apart from that being their spouse, significant other, their child. So they really have lost two things, and they don't know what to do with themselves. You know, all of a sudden, everything that they focused on was getting this person, you know, through day to day, taking care of them, feeding them, washing them, you know, being there. And now both of those roles, as the caregiver and as the spouse or significant other or parent, have both disappeared. So a lot of times it's understanding that, you know, you do still have, you know, a life that can continue. You do still have things that you can do. You know, all of a sudden they find themselves with time on their hands because all of their time was dedicated to this other person. So, you know, understanding that there are ways to, you know, to try to recapture some of that person that they themselves are now, sometimes takes a bit of work too.
In terms of the pandemic and collective grief, what's some guidance that you can offer for listeners who sense this mounting loss all around?
Well, again, I think, you know, connecting with other people, whether it's by phone, if that's, you know, the way that, you know, I always ask our group support members if it's okay to share, you know, phone numbers. And some people are all right with that and others are not, and that's understandable. But, you know, having somebody that you've connected with on some level to be able to just give a call and say, you know, how are you doing? And then the person, you know, exchanges with you, well, how are you doing? And you can kind of, again, go back and forth. I think, you know, we have to look at ways of networking with other people and maybe, you know, ways that we've never really embraced in the past. And most people, you know, would really rather, everyone would really rather be face-to-face and, you know, see, you know, how this other person is reacting and the body language and, you know, all of us, you know, I have a very difficult time. I'm a handshaker and a hugger. So, you know, the elbow bump is what I have to do now for safety reasons. But, you know, those things that we used to do to be able to show comfort to someone else, we kind of have to rethink how that is. And if it's a voice on the other end of the phone just saying, you know, how's it going for you today? Is there anything you need? Can I help you with anything? Sometimes, again, that comes just at that moment when the person is thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. So, you know, developing those kind of networks, whether it's through neighbors in a community or through, you know, groups or something that people used to belong to, that, you know, start sort of a phone chain just to kind of check in. And I think, again, we're, you know, going into the wintertime, it's dark, it's cold, people are less likely to be able to be out of their houses even if they were able to. And so, you know, making those connections to be, you know, calling somebody once or twice a week or, you know, just checking in, making sure that somebody's okay.
Communication.
Mm-hmm.
Remind folks how they can learn more about the grief support group during the holidays.
Well, this one is called Surviving the Holidays. It will run on Monday evenings from 6 to 7. Begins on Monday, November 23rd, and it runs through Monday, December 28th. So we get through Thanksgiving, we get through the beginnings of Christmas, and right up until, you know, a couple of days before the New Year, because those for, again, for people that are experiencing the loss, especially the first time, is sometimes most difficult. But it is at Wayne Memorial Hospital in Honesdale. It will be on the second floor. If you go into the building, you have to use the COVID precautions. So at that time of night, you have to come in through the emergency room. They will take your temperature. You do need to be masked. We do try to, you know, practice social distancing in the large room, and we're upstairs on the second floor using the old entrance there by the emergency room. Second floor, it's called the DK room, the David Katz conference room, and you can go online at the WMH.org website and look for a registration form. But some people have difficulty printing, don't have a printer, so that's never a problem. I always have extra registration forms with me that you can, you know, fill out if you, you know, decide to participate. And we welcome anybody who's, you know, interested, even if you're just coming because you think it might be something that would be helpful, or you know, somebody that you think would be benefited by it. You know, we always again say, come see what you, you know, what you feel after the first night, and if it works and does, you know, make you feel more supported, then that's great. And if for some reason you feel it's just not, you know, what you need at the time, there's always, you know, we do it, you know, the holiday group we do every year now. It's probably been about 6 or 7 years, and we do periodically throughout the year support groups that run 6-week sessions at a time, you know, through the spring and the summer and into the fall.
Anna Walsh, social worker with Wayne Memorial Hospital, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are very welcome. Thank you, Tim.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tomorrow, the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center and Gender Equality New York present a virtual Transgender Day of Remembrance Memorial. It's at 7 p.m. via Zoom. They hope to bring an emotional and moving memorial to our community, allies, and the general public. We spoke to Gender Equality New York Board Chair and Executive Director Julie Gray Owens about the origins of the Day of Remembrance and plans for tomorrow's event.
Back in 1998, there was a trans woman by the name of Rita Hester, whose murder on November 28th started the project. What they did was that year they did a candlelight vigil and then followed it up the following year doing it the same way again. And it just spread from there. So it's actually been around since 1998, and it started because of a trans woman's murder in San Francisco.
Unfortunately, the murder of trans women is not new. It's something that's seemingly increasing. Can you talk a little bit about that, and why does this continue to persist in the community?
Well, first of all, what we see where we see the worst cases are transgender women of color. Obviously, they face not only stigmatization because they're transgender, but then, of course, racial issues are also brought in, and they're usually in situations, you know, in areas where they live and so forth, where they may be, you know, just higher crime areas and so forth. So the transgender community as a whole suffers from, you know, economical equality, if you will. There's just not enough jobs, and there's you know, a lot of people out on the street without work. Many of the people are food insecure, homeless, If they do have a home, you know, it's just a bare minimum type of situation. So what we end up seeing is we see a community of people that, you know, are, first of all, you know, basically a target for hate groups. But we also have a situation where a lot of cases where trans women may be found to be attractive to men. And if they find out that this person that they've been attracted to happens to have started out life as a male, but obviously their gender identity is female, but they usually have an issue about that and have a violent reaction. And a lot of that is what ends up happening to the transgender community, and more specifically, trans women of color. So that's kind of what we're facing as far as the reality of, you know, life in the transgender community. This day, this memorial, is used to make people aware of the hate crimes against our community. We don't feel that media really performs the job that they should be doing. They're getting better, but it certainly has in the past been a hard job to get people to be aware of the amount of hate crimes and violence that is done against our community. The other thing is that it's an opportunity for us to take these people and memorialize them and recognize their lives, recognize that many of them had families who lost loved ones, that type of thing. So we want to make sure that you know, we always put them above and memorialize them. And it's important for, and I'm going to use a term called cisgender, and I don't know if everyone understands what that is.
Can you explain to listeners who may not know what that is?
Absolutely. Cisgender simply means not transgender. And to take it to a step further, what it means is people whose personal identity matches the sex assigned them at birth. Everything starts out at birth. That's how we all get labeled at that point. You know, it's a boy or it's a girl. Those people who their identity matches the sex that they're given at birth are called cisgender. Those of us who do not match the designation that we're given at birth are transgender. And if you took a look at the word cisgender, it's C-I-S and then gender. That prefix is from a Latin word meaning on the same side. And trans, of course, actually comes from a Latin word meaning across. So you can see where transgender meaning across gender and cisgender meaning on the same side, where they have their, you know, their beginnings from. So we are looking to make sure that cisgender people understand that we are their children. We could be their parents, their partners, their friends, their coworkers, and their neighbors. And it gives our allies a chance to step forward and stand with us in vigil so that we can memorialize those that we've lost through transphobic violence.
This week, there's an annual list compiled by the group Trans Respect versus Transphobia Worldwide, which lists the number of people killed in 2020. That was 350 transgender people killed this year. That's a rise from last year, 331. According to the report, a fifth of the transgender people murdered were killed inside their own house. Mm-hmm. The average age of those killed was 31, the youngest just 15.
Yeah.
This is so troubling, but does that even represent the number of hate crimes and murders? Are there more even unreported and misreported?
Well, I think what you're saying is absolutely the truth. We are another issue that our community has is that we are constantly being misgendered. So even though a person may show the world as, let's say, female, when the reporting comes, it will say, you know, a man was killed. You know, that type of thing. So we're never sure exactly what the reporting is. And I can tell you, specifically in South American countries, and in Africa, there are a lot of, you know, violence that where we're very, very positive is never reported. People are just gone missing, and nothing is ever found out about them or anything like that. And even here in the States, when you go through the list and you analyze every single one of the murders that occurred in the past year, it's amazing how many of the cases are listed as still open with no end in sight. And, you know, is that because it just happens to be that way, or is it because perhaps there's less interest by officials to investigate and get down and into the nitty-gritty of why someone was murdered? So, again, you know, this is what we face. We're sure that the numbers that are being reported are underreported. However, the number is growing because people are becoming more and more aware, and there is more reporting. And, of course, social media, you know, is now around the world, so that there is a much better case for reporting, but we still think it's very much underreported.
Gender equality advocates for transgender, gender non-binary, and intersex rights for New Yorkers and their families. How are transgender rights in general, are they regressing? Are they progressing? Does it depend on the part of the world in which you live? As you mentioned, Central and South America recorded the highest number of deaths. Where does it stand currently in your view?
Well, if we look around the world, it would be a terrible thing to look at, and it would be very disheartening. Some countries are still requiring surgery in order for people to be able to change their identity papers, their names, that type of thing. Federally here in the United States, we have seen our rights be taken away from us. Many people are aware of the fact that transgender non-binary service people were refused to be able to continue to serve our country, which had a major impact on our community because, as we all understand, especially with poor people, the military is a way of people improving themselves, a way of getting jobs, a way of helping our country, but helping themselves as well. So when you close that door, it does impact the community. I would say that here in New York State, it took us 16 years to pass the Transgender Civil Rights Bill. It was called the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, or better known as the acronym GENDA. That was passed finally in January of 2019. But we are still fighting for bills to be passed. Currently, we're waiting for the governor to sign a bill that would allow gender-neutral bathrooms in public places, and it would only be for single-stall bathrooms. So we're not talking about, you know, a large ladies' room with multiple stalls. All we're looking for is, for example, if you go to a McDonald's, sometimes when you walk into McDonald's, you'll find a men's room on the left and a women's room on the right, and they're both single-stall bathrooms. You know, the door locks, there's one toilet, one sink, that's it. And we're asking for the signs to be changed to gender neutral on both those doors. That not only helps our community, but it also helps families where, for example, if you're a dad and you have two small children and both are little girls, worrying about which door you go into or which bathroom you can use. It also helps people who are not able-bodied, who may have an aide who's a different gender than they are. And to be able to need that help and go in a bathroom, it makes it so much easier if the single stall bathroom has a label on it that just says anyone can use it. We don't believe that it's costly. We feel that, you know, someone could take a piece of copy paper and write on it all gender and tape it on the door and would be fine, but we're having a problem getting the governor to pass it right now, you know, sign it right now, which is crazy.
Well, what do you think is the holdup?
There's a belief that I think that there's a cost associated, but there is no, you know, within the bill, we are not asking for any type of plumbing changes. This would not impact any of the larger multi-stall bathrooms, simply just the, you know, single stall bathroom, you know, one door, one toilet, one sink, that's it, that type of thing. We're also having a problem getting the leadership of both the Senate and the Assembly to bring a bill forward which would remove a penal code, a New York State penal code, which allows police to stop and arrest women who they think might be loitering in case of prostitution. And there are cases of both cisgender women and transgender women just walking down the street or waving to a car that they know the people in and having actually been stopped by police, frisked, and in some cases jailed. Just because they were walking on the street. So it becomes a real issue, especially when you look into it and you find out that basically there's been so much, so it's so poorly written that it allows police to profile. And what's happening is that it's allowing police to profile women of color. And obviously that impacts our community as well as, you know, just cisgender women. But again, it's people of color. So, you know, these are pieces of legislation that should be no-brainers, that we should be able to pass and make a better world for everyone, not just for trans women or trans men, for that matter.
What's the roadblock in this piece of legislation?
We believe that it probably was a case of fear coming up with the election. There was a lot of pushback with, you know, the changes in bail and bail reform and so forth. So there was a lot of, I think there was a lot of fear with that. But again, the clock is ticking. We have a significant number, in fact, more than half in both houses as far as co-sponsors for the bill. And so now it's time to get the bill passed. And I don't know that they were going to be, you know, continuing the 2020 legislative session. But we believe it's an important piece of legislation that should be passed on the first day of the 2021 legislative session.
There's a virtual Transgender Day of Remembrance at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center. It's a time for, as you mentioned, to raise public awareness of hate crimes against transgender people, but also a chance to honor the lives of people in the community who might otherwise be forgotten. Is there someone that you're personally reflecting upon during this time or for this day?
No, actually, I look at it in a different way. As a community advocate who's been doing this now for 17 years, I see community members, and for that matter, their family and friends, who every year will come to these memorials and cry about the seriousness of our loss. And our message that we're hoping that people are going to receive is that it's time to stop crying. And it's time to start taking action, whether it be legislatively, whether it be, you know, through, you know, whatever means we need to within society. But there's work that has to be done. There's letters that have to be written. There's calls that have to be made. To waste, you know, a whole year, you know, wait till next year and we'll read another list of names and we'll cry again, but not do anything within the next 52 weeks, we think is a shame, and we think that it's necessary for people to realize that, yes, this is a horrible thing, and we must, you know, remember these people in our best way that we can, but we can't allow this to keep happening year after year after year. Changes have to be made. One of the things that our organization does is we do trainings. We do trainings across the state. We meet with church groups. I'm currently right now training Northwell Health here at on Long Island at the hospital here in Huntington. I'm also training at the Nassau County Police Academy, where we hopefully are getting recruits and starting to get them to understand a little bit about what we call the gender expansive community, and how their actions can help our community rather than harm us. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, and we're hoping that, yes, we do take the time to think about those members that we've lost, but I think it's more important to make a commitment to the next year, put all of our efforts into making changes so that we can make a more equal world for everyone.
The candlelight vigils are fine, but you want people to be vigilant.
Exactly.
Can you
take that fire instead of lighting the candle and let's make some change?
How will you get that point across during the Day of Remembrance tomorrow?
Well, what's interesting is we actually have made a significant change in our presentation. In fact, when we initially started putting the program together, we in the past had graphically described how these people had been murdered, the overkill that was done in murdering these people. I mean, for example, unfortunately, one of the victims not only was murdered and stabbed, but had their legs cut off after they were murdered. You know, it's an overkill situation where it's not enough to just, you know, bang your dead. It's now I have to destroy you so that if anyone sees you, they need to be fearful that they should not show their face in the public, you know, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So we're going away from that. We think there are two positive reasons for it. Number one is that what ends up happening is these victims end up being a representation of their murder rather than of their life. And so we are doing everything we can, whether it's on social media or just interviews where we see from friends and family that talk about the person as a positive, as a, you know, someone who lit up the room or someone who had dreams of someday, as an example, designing clothes or whatever it happened to be. So we are looking to name the person. You know, we point out the date of their passing. But the story that we tell about them is not how we lost them, but what they brought to the world when they were alive. So that's our first step. So we want to take this from a triggering event to one of, first of all, honoring those people. And we believe by doing that, we can make it easier for people to start realizing that there are specific steps that can be taken to start making changes. You know, just making people aware of the fact that there is a transgender community out there and that we do have rights and, you know, privileges that should be given to us like everyone else. We shouldn't have the discrimination that's going on. Making people aware of the fact that our community exists. One of the things that we do is basically a gender 101 and start getting people aware of the fact that, you know, we are a significant part of the community. And they need to be aware of it, and they need to adjust how they deal with us in schools, whether they deal with us, you know, with restrooms, how things are designed, I mean, the whole thing. And for businesses and organizations, something as simple as putting your pronouns in your signature line of your email, or if you have a job, for example, like a hospital, you know, someone who, a staff member in the hospital, perhaps their badge should not only say, you know, Mary Jones, but also list her pronouns as she, her, hers. Or, you know, John Smith, you know, he, him, his. What that does is that signals acceptance of the fact that there are people that you do have to ask about their pronouns. It may not be exactly clear about that. And it shows respect to our community. So, you know, these are the type of steps that we think that need to be taken.
And there's registration on the website, or how can folks register?
Go to our website, which is genderequalityny.org. There is a registration link for this. Hurleyville Performing Arts Center is our co-sponsor, and I believe they may have it on their website as well. We are being obviously careful with security. Once you register and we approve the registration, you will get your own private personal registration, and we ask that you not share it with anyone. And then you join the event on Sunday at 7 p.m.
It is on the website for Hurleyville. That's hurleyvilleartcenter.org. And your website is genderequalityny.org.
Correct.
We've been speaking with Julie Gray Owens, Board Chair and Executive Director of Gender Equality New York, about the virtual Transgender Day of Remembrance. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. And Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Remember, be kind, stop the spread, and wear a mask.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF, especially during these unusual times. Listeners like you tell us they love what we're doing. But remember, it's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Give what you can at WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., handpicked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
Support comes from the Livingston Manor Chamber of Commerce, your destination for dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Mountains. LivingstonManorNY.com. and from listener donations at wjffradio.org.
Coming up next, more locally produced programming. It's Farm and Country with Rosie Starr and friends. And then we've got Greg Triggs, actually, on for Donna during Catskill Character. And then at noon, Janice Adams and Staying Home with Josh Fox follows at 1. All locally produced programming right here in our community on your community radio station. Today's forecast, partly cloudy with some sun mixed in, a high of 44. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania.